Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Welcome back to the Personal Wealth Coach. This is hour two of March 11th. Yes, we say the day began on March 11th, 1 hour ago, because that's when we started our radio program. How's that for ego? This is our second hour broadcasting, I should say. And we have lots of stuff to talk about. The biggest thing in the news we spent most of the first hour talking about was the 16th largest bank in the country collapsing, the Silicon Valley Bank. And we mentioned just a tiny bit in passing Silvergate, another bank collapsing there. We mentioned also in passing Circle, the crypto sort of not really crypto place that just kind of secondary banking world. It's stablecoin, which is supposed to be stuck to $1 for one unit, broke its peg, which means it's not marked to the dollar anymore. It's down to 87 cents on the dollar. Why? Because they had a bunch of the deposits of dollars stuck over in SVB. So when we say there's knock-on effects, or when we say collapse means that others are lapsing at the same time, expect this kind of to ripple through the crypto community for sure, and definitely through the venture capital and startup community.
I like that, ripple through the crypto.
Ripple through the crypto.
That's yes. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would not be surprised that one of the next headlines is that you see a run on Circle stablecoin and them shut down.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of this is the same thing. It's all a case of people assuming that there is no risk where there is, in fact, a lot of risk. And I've been beating that drum this entire program. I've been beating that drum for a long time. But it's important to recognize any place you pool your money with other people's money because you want to get an interest rate or a return on it, there is risk. Now, the United States government has taken some very specific actions and pass some very specific laws to change the nature of or ameliorate that risk. You need to know what they are and what they cover. And it's so important that you know need to know whether or not there is a backing to the place where you put your money. And most people, 99.99% of the people I talk to, are just blissfully unaware of the insecurity or the unsecured nature of places they put their money. It drives me crazy.
One of the things that we've harped on this for years, so we're not jumping on the bandwagon now that the collapse has occurred. We pointed at this as being a representation of shadow banks that have always occurred. We get these waves of sort of banks so we don't have to be regulated, and then they collapse, and then another one comes along, and then they collapse, and then another one. And they happen over these long, long periods of time in my career. Before my career, before your career, everything was shadow banking. There wasn't regulated banking in the United States. We went about 100 years, little less than 100 years, without a central bank. Andrew Jackson got rid of our equivalent of the Federal Reserve, and we didn't get another one until the beginning of the 20th century after the collapse of 1907. And I want to bring a local to our area story into this. One of the very first college in Texas that was co-ed began in the mid to late 1800s in Salado, Texas. Well, that's where we both live. It is just a ruin now, but it was a establishment. Four governors of the state of Texas graduated from there. It was as established a university as you could get in Texas at the time. When it was made, there were still battles with the natives occurring. So this goes way back. It burned down, and there was this big urge to raise more money. Local families donated land to auction off to rebuild the college. So then they got that done, and they got insurance on the building after it burned down. And so it burned down again, and the insurance paid, and they rebuilt the building again. And they said, we really need insurance on this thing, keeps burning down. And there was some thought of arson at the time. There's all kinds of conspiracy theories that live through time on this. Then it burned down again. and they got paid their insurance money and they deposited it at the bank. And this was 1907. And the bank collapsed, as did banks all the way across the country. And J.P. Morgan, the man, not the company, stepped in with his own private wealth and dumped a bunch of money into the banking system to shore it up and said, we really need a central bank to do this because at some point you're not going to have one financial person with enough cash on hand to do this. Elon Musk doesn't have a bunch of cash on hand. It's tied up in all these investments. That's what he's talking about. Somebody has to have a bunch of cash sitting on the sidelines, ready to just dump it into the system to prevent whole systems from breaking down. So this is where the FDIC comes in. And this is where the Federal Reserve Bank comes in. It's a banking system with a huge network of banks that pay it money. The interest that is charged to the banks for their deposits and vice versa. The Federal Reserve winds up being very profitable here because they're available as the lender of last resort, the ones that can step in and say, here's a bunch of money to shore up the system. A shadow bank isn't involved in that system at all. And a lot of the crypto banks, there's the one that we're talking about right now is Circle Internet Financial, meant to mimic the value of the U.S. dollar, and called their coin the USD coin. USD meaning United States dollar coin. Well, there's already a United States dollar coin. There's Susan Anthony on one of them. So from a perspective of naming propriety, this sounds a lot safer than it is. It sounds like you're saying this is a U.S. dollar coin. You deposit here, it's just the same as a dollar, only we're going to pay you some interest too. Well, they had deposits at banks to help back up that dollar. And the bank just lost its assets. And the amount of money that they had deposited at that bank was a lot, measured in lots of billions. And when that's now tied up, that's obviously above the FDIC limit. The FDIC was there to protect small investors. Big investors are supposed to know to put their money in other places, but they needed it liquid and they wanted to make a little bit of interest on the money so that they could pay it back too. And so they put it in the bank that was offering the highest interest rate. And anytime, even safe banks, this is FDIC stuff, any deposit you have above the FDIC limit, if that bank is paying you more than the other banks, there's a reason why. Always. This isn't maybe there's a reason why. This isn't, they're just doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They want to pay you more money because they're just friendly. We're talking about a bank. It's not being friendly. Why are they paying more? There's ways as an individual you can game that system. The Puerto Rico bank, the whole banking system of Puerto Rico had a collapse not that long ago. And they were paying the absolute highest interest rates on all their stuff. And if you stayed within the FDIC insurance coverage, you got to reap the benefit of that extra interest until they went under, and then you got your money back. But if you put everything you had there way above what was insured, it was not safe, and you lost a lot of money. You got some of your money back. It was not 100% loss. It wasn't even a 50 cent loss per dollar. But quite often, you're talking about 80 cents to 90 cents on the dollar for this sort of thing, because those federally backed banks and the FDIC says you have to have other stuff to back this. When we look at what's going to happen to the people who had their money at SVB, what is, and Stephen sent us an email and basically had questions pretty down to the details of what we've already answered, but I'm going to go the next layer out. If a big company, a startup company, a little company with a lot more than $250,000 had their deposits at SVB, what does that mean? Well, SVB does have investments, a portfolio of investments to back it up. They loaned money to the United States government, just longer term. And that money, if they sold that contract, that bond, if they sold it today, it's worth less than what they loaned because interest rates have gone up. If they hold them to the end, to the 30-year point, they'll get all their money back. So some kind of balance is where the regulators come in and say, how do we liquidate these assets without destroying the value of the assets to get the most back to the people who are owed. So just because you don't have the FDIC insurance doesn't mean you lose everything, but you're going to lose something in a lot of cases. And we're not used to that. The global financial crisis hit and the FDIC did something weird. This is 2008, 2009. They covered everybody without regard to limit. They didn't stop at $250,000, and we're used to that now. The year before that, it had been limited to $100,000, and they jumped it up. They never tied it to inflation, so it's the same value as it was in 07. But that's the point, is that we need to be aware that risks exist and that the government's not going to come and bail you out every time, and you have something to add or take just in a different direction.
I want to agree with you, and I think one of the things that has happened here is we do not listen to Jorge Santayana, who said, "Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it." The last financial crisis, when financial institutions failed, routinely the government stepped in and rescued the people who had their money there, way, as Jake said, way above the FDIC insurance levels or anything else.
It was just a blanket rescue to everybody.
And there's a name for that, and it's called moral something.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Moral risk, or it's moral something.
Moral hazard?
Moral hazard.
There you go. Okay.
Like, it's kind of like Merle Haggard.
Right. Merle Haggard. Yeah.
Merle Haggard.
Yeah. Well, the banks moral have hazard. Merle Haggard involved here.
And moral hazard was talked about a lot at the time. The alternative to doing that was to watch the economy crater into a depression. So they had a choice. They could either step in and do something that might generate another collapse down the road, because people would assume the government wasn't going to do what the law said, but rather expediently jump in and fix things. And I think a good decision was made by George Bush and
Ben Bernanke
and all the other people who were involved in basically bailing out a bunch of banks.
Yeah, it was not popular by any means. It's never popular to bail out banks.
But without it, we almost certainly would have entered into a depression and probably a war. Instead, we came through it smelling like roses, and we have been fundamentally, and I know this is almost strange, recovering from that ever since. The event of the bailout, which is one of the reasons interest rates have been so low.
I just have to add that what we smell like coming out of a financial event might have more to do with what cologne or shampoo you use than what.
I'm just
saying that. That's all.
You definitely have a point there. But this is where we are today. And again, how many times have I said this? But if you're just tuning in, look at where your money is. What is the protection for it if the institution holding it goes under? Does it apply to you? Three questions. You got to ask that question. $250,000, generally speaking, read the fine print, $250,000 deposited in deposited in an account at a bank insured by the FDIC, you're pretty safe.
Just read the fine print. Make sure you're covered.
There are some exceptions there, because it has to be U.S. money and there's a whole series of things. But a lot of people have a lot more money than that, and they got to find some place to put it.
And if you
they think, and they're making assumptions, they're making big assumptions. And I'll just come right out and say, one of the things is, and I hope I'm wrong. Lord knows I hope I'm wrong, and I don't know that I'm right. But since I saw this happen once before, I can see it happening again. A lot of money over the last several years has gone to life insurance companies to buy single premium deferred annuity. Those single premium deferred annuities, in many cases, were offering to pay you 3%. Does it sound familiar if you listened to us talk about SVB Bank a minute ago? Offering to pay you 3% when the banks were only paying you at most 1%. So people jumped into the annuity and they have their money there, and there's a surrender charge on it in many cases, so they're scared to get it out. But if we repeat history, we're going to do what happened in the early 1980s. People are going to look at the fact that this insurance company is giving them 3% and they're really happy. But they look at the bank and the bank starts to offer them 5%.
And there's no surrender charge at the bank.
Well, there's a little one. 6 months interest in some cases.
Right.
But they look at the surrender charge on their annuity and they say, I'm willing to pay that to get that higher interest rate. And they start pulling the money out. then the annuity companies are going to have to start selling those long-term bonds that they bought with a 3 or 4% interest rate at a loss because interest rates are up. The difference between SVB and an insurance company is if they go under, there is no federal agency that insures anything in a life insurance or annuity company. Now, some of their products, the variable products, the separate account, generally, not always, read the prospectus and read your contract, is covered under the Investment Company Act of 1940, so the creditors of the insurance company can't get to it. But if you have a fixed interest rate annuity, you have made a loan to an insurance company. That's what happens. If the insurance company goes under, you need to know what happens.
Or the fixed account, even in a variable product.
So anytime an insurance company guarantees you an interest rate, you have made a loan to an insurance company, and it's as good as the insurance company, which is a single company. And if that company goes under, you really need to understand what happens if the person, the entity to whom you have made this loan, runs out of money.
Yeah, and let me just say that when you sign a credit card agreement, you're issuing a guarantee that you'll pay back what the debt that you accrue and the interest that's charged on it. You're issuing a guarantee, and you say this is a guaranteed loan, but it's only as good as you. And if your credit rating's really bad, your guarantee's not worth a lot. So due diligence and looking at the underlying portfolio at an insurance company, and knowing that if you're locking something up for a long period of time or forever with little to no recourse, you really should do your due diligence in advance. Right. And we have another question out there as well from Inquisitor John. But if you want to change, we can come back to that.
What's the question? Which question are you referring to?
China. He's looking at an article in the Wall Street Journal.
Reagan 2.0, right.
Yeah. And Inquisitor John, thank you again for your questions every week. We really love them. The article says China's cities struggle under trillions in debt, and there's lots of information on that. His question is, Reagan 2.0, is this outcome anything similar to Reagan's success in outspending the Russians leading to the collapse of the Soviet Union? Is the CCP next? And that's a big question.
No,
it's not the same because it's not related to defense spending and the rest. What is similar is the way the United States expanded in the Industrial Revolution. There was a lot of debt that came from that. So let me give the parallel here. The time of U.S. Steel being the largest company on the planet, where when Carnegie, and by the way, if you take Carnegie's wealth and apply inflation to it, his net worth was, if you took about the top 100 of the richest people in the world today and combined them. There's no comparison. They're really not. He owned all the steel on the planet. All of the steel, ability to create steel, period, was owned by one man. This is why we have antitrust laws.
and the railroads were owned by another one, Vanderbilt.
Right. So you had this series, and this is the time of the robber barons and blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that if you look at what happened then and replaced Andrew Carnegie with the U.S. government and say the U.S. government owned all the steel production and subsidized it in its sales to U.S. companies, because in effect, that's what Carnegie was doing. He gave discounts to American companies. He charged the French a lot of money for steel, stuff like that. He made decisions kind of like a government would if they controlled the steel. He could change governments. That he did. He was not well liked in some places. So Andrew Carnegie replaced him and the United States government with the Chinese government. And then you have to throw in a bunch of other private institutions at the time. The banking system of the United States was not really a system. It was a bunch of individual banks. We didn't have a central bank for a big chunk of this. And the loans that were given out to companies to start up, to go and charge other companies loans to go and do work, building bridges, skyscrapers, roads, and so on. We had some financial collapses in there. We had some relatively big ones, one called the Great Depression, because the loans and the ownership weren't regulated well. We can see China walking down that path right now. Their banking system is not a, I mean, it is a system. It's all interconnected. but there's as much shadow banking or more as real banking, because the banks are owned by the country. They're state owned, and a lot of stuff has to be done outside of that system. Well, now they're moving to a digital yuan, and that's going to make the shadow banking harder, and you're seeing some of that now. In the middle of all of this, the Chinese government went on, if we went on steroids to stimulate our economy in the Great Recession, they have gone on super steroids, and they've basically kept that super steroid level going for the last several decades. Where did they get the money to loan to the companies to build the cities that nobody lived in? Where did they get the money to loan to companies to build bridges and roads that either didn't get completed or weren't completed well? Well, it was just basically made by the government. But then they put price controls in areas to keep the currency from inflating too quickly and linked it to the dollar. And we have all kinds of back and forth with the U.S. government of, stop linking your money to the dollar. You're giving out too many loans. So this buildup is something we've talked about over the last several decades on the air. The Chinese have been issuing loans from their state banks that are not payable. You can see that in their Belt and Road. You can see that that's internationally. But you can see it really clearly internally in their financial structure. And there's a lot of ways for countries to move out of that. There's basically just let everybody collapse and rebuild. That's kind of what the United States has done repeatedly. Just let them go. We'll kind of help the hangers-on and the people that weren't directly involved in the collapse, but the rest of you guys just lost everything. Figure it out. Where the Japanese said, nope, nobody fails here. Just because nobody can pay you back their debts, banks, we're going to keep you in business. And that led to them being in a stagnation for several decades. They went from one of the highest growth countries to really stagnant because they couldn't get rid of the bad debt. So what happens next for the CCP is, how do they deal with this debt? Bill Clinton had the last time in the United States where we had a surplus and not a deficit. It was under Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House on the Republican side and Bill Clinton as the president for the Democrats. So who gets credit for that? Well, you guys can argue it out. It doesn't matter. The effect was that George H.W. Bush and before him Ronald Reagan had presided over Democratic Congresses, so this is a flip of what we see when the surplus occurred, to build what's called the Resolution Trust Corporation. The U.S. government went and bought up a bunch of bad properties that the savings and loan companies had. These savings and loans companies couldn't pay back their depositors, so the government came in and bought up their assets. And at the time, the Republicans were shrieking about how this was just a government bailout, and the Democrats were saying, well, why doesn't the government just own all the banks anyway? Both of those are extreme positions. Over the following years, those properties were sold back into the market at massive profits to the United States government. And that was a big chunk of the surplus that we had. Then we had a Republican president come in and said, we have this massive surplus, we just need to lower taxes, which is very rational, very reasonable. And then we got attacked and started a major war without bringing the taxes back up. So now we have a very major dissonance between our inflows and our outflows. And who made good decisions and who made bad decisions is irrelevant. This is where we are. So going back to China's going to be in a different kind of mess than what we have. Depending on what they do, they are currently in the process of continuing to stomp down on innovation. They went from this several decade practice of slowly loosening the thumbscrews on people being able to produce their own stuff that wasn't owned by the government to, in the last 4 years, really since right before the pandemic hit, bringing the hammer down on anybody that sticks their heads up or in any way innovating or becoming wealthy. And they're institutionalizing it rather than making it one-off deals at this point, which is throwing their entire growth model into question, come from one end to the other, at the same time when all these debts are also coming due. So China's is in a really weird place. They could devalue their currency slowly. They could fast do it. They could try to grow themselves out of this. But the reality is there's a lot of bad debt out there. And at some point, that is going to have an impact. In Japan, they said, we'll just spread out the impact of that over 20 years and not have a single catastrophic downturn in the economy, but a long drawn out stagnation. Now, I think I kicked that one enough. Let me kick it one more time.
We just came in with a report that last month we had 311,000 new jobs created in the United States. That's way more than the economy needs in a steady state. That indicates the economy is growing and growing significantly. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates to reduce spending. Well, if you have 311,000 people with new jobs, they now have money they're going to spend, which means spending just went up. Is that bad? Well,
it's not bad for them.
That's one of the reasons the market dipped last week. Or this week, is because the concern is the Fed will look at that and start raising interest rates faster and raise it further and throw us into a real recession at some point. Well, let me give you the backside of that. I'm thinking the folks at the Federal Reserve are smart enough to recognize this. Wages in that month only went up 0.2%. What does that mean? If we annualize, and that's the way they've been going for about 3 months now. Wages have been rising at about a 2.4%. annual rate. The Fed is concerned that we'll get into a wage price spiral where, because of inflation, wages will rise really fast, and because of the high demand for new employees, wages will rise really fast. Well, they're not. As a matter of fact, while 2.4% sounds a little steep because it's more than the Fed wants to see prices go up, we also, in the last quarter of last year, and it was pretty consistent through last year, raised our productivity on an annualized rate at 1.7%, which is great. What does all that mean? Well, if wages go up at 2.4% a year and productivity goes up at 1.7% a year, what we have is a 0.7% additional money without value coming into the economy. That would ultimately, in a perfect world and where the math is simple, lead to 0.7% inflation going forward, which was way below the Fed's target of 2%. Here's my hope. The Fed is going to see those numbers and they're really smart. And they're going to recognize that those numbers don't signal inflation. But there's another implication to those numbers, though, that's very important. When a recession is on the way in, the first people to really know it are the business people who pay people, who hire people, who watch how their customers are behaving. They are not seeing evidence of a recession. This is very, very, very unusual. What they're seeing is evidence of a fast-growing economy. They are sensing certainly some evidence of inflation because the stuff they buy that they use to either provide services or provide product has been going up too fast. And that's a different issue altogether. But they don't see a recession coming. So this is, again, very different because in the past, businesses saw the recession coming before the tea leaves turned. The tea leaves have turned, and they've turned violently, saying massive recession, which, by the way, according to the stuff that came in last year, should be going on right now.
Well, let me explain that real quick. When we look at the index of leading economic indicators, it's a whole series of things, housing starts and confidence levels and things like that. And before, when it drops below a certain point, usually means that you have a recession coming in under 12 months. Well, our indicators were all out of whack starting in July of last year. We're right at the point where this is supposed to be when we're in the recession, based on what it's done, but it's only got a history at those leading indicators since the 70s, because we didn't have the records to measure before that. The surveys weren't being done. And so to say that we know for sure that every time this happens, that will lead to this, it's like saying anything else predictively. You don't know. We don't know. And when we look at the indicators are all saying this doesn't look good for growth. And yet we have growth.
I My sense of what's going on, and my sense is certainly the worm's eye view, is that the economy is going to do well. It's going to be slowed by the higher interest rates. Mm-hmm. We're going to see some things come down. And inflation is not going to go back to zero. As a matter of fact, between 2 and 3% is probably where inflation is going to settle in. Why is that? And can I take a few minutes to explain this? I don't want to
monopolize this. Go right ahead.
We are going through a major historic economic change, a huge one. Not at the moment. It is going on right now, but it has been going on since the 1980s. What happened a long time ago under Richard Nixon is that we normalized relationships, the relationship with China. We recognized the communist government and unrecognized the democratic government of China. By the way, this type of thing typically happens under conservatives, not under liberals, for those of you who want to be political about this. It just happens consistently that way. So what happened? We took the largest nation on the planet that contained a third of the world population, and in an agrarian society where people were still using oxen to plow their fields.
And often were standing in mud puddles with sticks, no right. metal involved.
And we brought them into the labor force of the world. And since then, the price of labor, which is the most expensive piece of anything normally, dropped like a rock. So that two things happened. Supply increased exponentially for almost anything you wanted to have made. And the price of getting it made fell like a rock. Now, let's fast forward from 1982 to 2002. Let's come 40 years into the future. If you've seen pictures of Shanghai or anywhere in China with their freeways clogged with new cars and their nice buildings, the standard of living in China and for most of the citizens of China is comparable, and people are making a big noise about that, saying their GDP is really bigger because their standard of living is equivalent to ours in many cases. Their standard of living has come up, which means they're making a lot more money than they were making 40 years ago. That is an understatement of the millennium right there. Well, how about India? Well, India's standard of living has come up. Their economy has come up. They're making a lot more money. Two effects from that. Number one, it's no longer dirt cheap to have things made in China or India, which means the prices are going to go up.
And just to anybody who's wondering, the statement dirt cheap has been made by people who never had to buy dirt. Go right ahead. Number two.
Well, okay. Number two, we have had a huge increase in demand. Because those people who were poking holes in the ground and planting rice, not the individuals necessarily, but the populations of nations that 50 years ago were poking holes in the ground and growing rice are now making a lot of money and buying stuff, a lot of stuff. So two things have happened. The cost of making things has risen and the demand has hugely increased. Economics 101, that equals a rise in prices, a steady rise in prices. Well, we can always go to Mexico. Well, guess what? It's happening in Mexico too.
Yeah, the standard of living there is much higher there than it was 20 years ago.
If we look back through the 20th century, inflation was going on the whole time. We have had a period of time recent when inflation dropped back to near zero and stayed there for a while. And I can, if you had lots of time, I can explain to you why that happened. But it was a very temporary event. Inflation in the 20th century ran around 3%. There is no reason inflation shouldn't run 3% in the 21st century. As a result, we have had a period of very low inflation and reversion to the mean raises its head. I expect inflation to be between 2 and 3% going forward. And the end result, and here's important, here's the practical effect that we're going to see. Interest rates on bonds and everything else aren't as high as they're going to get, and they're going to continue to go up, and they're going to get back to what we previously called normal, and they're probably going to stay there. The concept that you ought to buy bonds right now, or you ought to do something right now because interest rates will drop back, has very little support in history or in economics. I can't even imagine why people would think that would happen, except for this. Most of the people who are saying these things and writing these things can't remember when it was otherwise. As a result, it's not going to return. I don't think it's going to return to zero interest rates and zero inflation. I don't think we're going to see that in our lifetime, at least not in mine, for sure. And get ready for higher interest. Well, Chairman Powell keeps saying it. Mm-hmm. Get ready for higher interest rates longer than you expect.
I want to throw in a two-minute thing before we go to commercials, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
You brought this up about people comparing Chinese GDP to ours and saying if it's similar, it's similar. We've talked about it in the past, but it's worth bringing up again. It's called PPP, or purchasing price parity. And from purely economics, it sounded really cool when it was first introduced in the late 90s and really got popular in the early 2000s. And you can see it still in a lot of the popular press. And often you can tell when that person went to school because of it. PPP was something really popular in the early 2000s in economics 101 stuff. The problem is that it's been pretty thoroughly debunked on a bigger level. Because a house in China, when we say they have the same standard of living, the issue there is that they don't have the same building codes and they don't have the same electrical codes and they don't have the same, you go down the list of safety measures that cost money, but they actually have a value for the money that you're paying. You know, things like having special walls in your house that prevent fire from going beyond a certain speed. These are things that cost extra. Having smoke detectors and exit doors that function in fires. This is not something that is universal in China at all. In fact, the plumbing system that they have and the building system that they have and the electrical system that they have, basically go down through every utility and every standard for quality for automobiles and so on. And you find that the standards are far, far lower in the background. And it's really hard to measure that. But the reality is you cannot have parity from one place to another. You have differences from one place to another. So San Francisco, somebody living in a high rise in San Francisco, living, eating every meal and paying all their bills, but just paying all their bills, is not living in the same standard as somebody living in a bayou paying all their bills in Louisiana. And that's within the same country. So that's all I wanted to say. Academically, it's been pretty thoroughly debunked, and the only major institution that's still holding on to it is the International Monetary Fund. And that tells you something in itself. So we've got to play some commercials. If you'd like to join the conversation, our email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. And we'll be back on the other side of these very important announcements. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We've got about a little less than 10 minutes left this week. If you have a question, now's a good time to send it in. Jake@tpwc.com and Jeff@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. And you have more to say. I can tell by the way you are looking.
Well, I've always got more to say, but I don't want to. I've had a lot to say during this thing.
Yeah. I just spent some time on PPP, and if people don't fall over asleep from price parity, purchasing price parity, then I don't know what insomnia cure could work for you.
Well, I got a email during the show that said 34, we said that 62% of the workforce is now in, of the eligible people are now in the workforce. And I got a, said that means that there are 38% of the people who are eligible to be working and they're not working. And the inference was that the government subsidies are keeping them from working.
No, this is, yeah. Why don't you jump into that one? There's a lot to say on that subject.
Well, first off, the person who wrote me this is, he and his wife are retired military, and they dropped out of the workforce at about 50 and haven't worked since.
That's part of the measurement here. If you're retired from a career and you could still go back to work, you're part of the workforce. Yeah.
They are living quite nicely on government subsidies. So he's saying that it's terrible, these government subsidies, and he gets really upset when he sees somebody at the store using a card to buy food.
Subsidy means it means able to survive on, or it means contributed. And if you earned the contribution, it's different than if you didn't. So a lot of people put the whole blanket, the government is paying subsidies, but Social Security is one of those subsidies, and so is military retirement. It does allow people not to work, but they're the ones that paid into it to begin with. That number you quoted, go ahead.
I wanted to say how I responded to him, and I think this is important to understand. First off, there are a couple of million people, about 2.75 million people, who probably are now, according to the studies from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who probably would be working were it not for government subsidies. Well, let me explain who most of those people are, though. In order to get those government subsidies, if you're in an age bracket and you're not disabled where you could be in the workforce, you almost have to have young children at home. If the reason this money is given to those people is so that they can feed their young children. This is important to understand. There have been a host of studies where we go back and look at what happened before the government provided food for low-income families with children. And one of the reasons the crime rate today, one of the prime reasons the crime rate today, the violent crime rate in the United States is roughly half of what it was back then. I know the media wouldn't make a big noise about that, but it is. It's literally about half of, per million people. The number of violent crimes is roughly half of what it was in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, there were some studies that went into prisons and looked at violent criminals and measured, they volunteered for this, obviously, and took a hard look at their brain. And they discovered that almost universally, they have a much smaller prefrontal cortex than the average person. The prefrontal cortex is where we recognize the long-term effects of something we're doing right now. And they also did other medical tests, and they discovered almost universally, like in the upper 90 percentile, they were showing signs of childhood malnutrition, a lack of protein specifically as children. And that's the issue. Once we started providing food stamps and cards and whatever we have been doing, aid to dependent children and SNAP and whatever we do to get money to buy food into the hands of people who have young children, it has dramatically cut violent crime in the United States. It has dramatically cut a lot of bad statistics out, but that's the one that probably has the most emotional impact. And it is basically mothers previously were working who had dependent children at home and left them at home alone. And if you say, well, why didn't they take them to daycare? Well, you haven't priced daycare today, because in many cases that I encountered in the past, the price of daycare was higher than what the person was making. So they stopped working. Sure enough, they dropped out of the labor force to take care of their children.
I'm going
to
say something interesting. The labor force, if you dig down into this increase in the labor force we've just discovered, because we just hired all these extra people and unemployment still went up. Well, what is that? Well, the labor force is having new people go into it. Well, who is it? Women are outnumbering men as new into the labor force by about a third right now. Coming out of the pandemic, men outnumbered women by a similar margin. Well, why? Well, because we still have a cultural thing that's part of our decision-making everywhere. Whether it's correct or not is irrelevant. It's there. And the thought was men are coming back to the workforce and women are staying and taking care of the kids. So this cultural phenomena that's part of history is still there. Well, now people are feeling, okay, we're really opening back up. I'm going back to work as well. And we're seeing that. That's where the increase comes from. The places where you're talking about where it's still not happening is still in that area, women at home with small children. And whether that's gender specific or any of the rest, when we look at this demographically, that's an of course moment when you're looking at history. And if we're a good country, then we're helping those young kids become better adults. And any investment we make to make those young kids as adults really good members of society, good education, if we invest in their brains, if we invest in their ability to eat, this has a good result long term. It's like building roads. It makes business better long term.
I've looked at this very carefully, and the vast majority of people who are receiving SNAP, you mentioned SNAP, they have the card, whatever it's called in a various state, where they can go to the grocery store and buy food with government benefits. The vast majority of them are in the position where they would vastly prefer not to have the card, but to have the higher benefits. The problem, and there is a problem there, and it needs to be addressed, is that once they start making, if they're working and they're getting SNAP and they start making a little more money, suddenly their benefits are cut and they're back to not being able to feed their children. And that does encourage them not to work, and it needs some fine tuning. And I'm sure, and I have seen abuse of it, but two things I want to throw, I know we're at the end of the hour, two things I want to throw out there. When I was a kid, we received government food without which I would have gone hungry.
When I was a kid, we did too.
Right. I was going to say, when I got out of the Army, we had kids, and I didn't realize when I got out of the Army, it was in the middle of a recession. Duh. But it was. And I couldn't find a job, and I couldn't make enough money to feed my kids. And the government supplied, I was a subject, or my family paid for it. And that's it. Go ahead.
Yeah. And we're out of time. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, it's ending on a kind of a tough moment, but phone numbers are 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. There's emails that you can send us there as well. Contact form, jeff@tpwc.com, jake@tpwc.com. You can sign up for our newsletter there and read it. You can find our podcasts anywhere where there are podcasts. Thank you very much for listening. We appreciate you all more than I can say. It's really cool to have this kind of support from our listeners. Thank you very much. This has been The Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back next week.